Welcome to another edition of Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host today. I am honored to be in the presence once again with my good friend, my great supporter, my former coffee party partner, as in board of director partner, Tim Danahue, but most of all, of the Tim Danahue show that we are trying like hell to get him to say, I will be back. Tim Danahue, how are you doing today, my brother?
I am doing well. The only way I'm ever coming back is if we do the Egberto and Danahue show. And because I hope that this show we're doing now really illustrates what I think we can spur in conversation. And while we may be superficial on a number of topics today, Egberto, talking with you creates a magic that I'm sure your listeners appreciate.
Well, look, it's a pleasure being with you, my brother. Let me just tell you, tell the audience, we are going to be talking about several issues. We're going to be talking about abortion issue. We're going to be talking about Rick Scott's minimum tax. We're going to be talking about the filibuster, tuition forgiveness, homelessness, English as an official language, election reform, voter ID, electoral college. And we hope we get to all of these within this 1 hour. If we don't, you know, we are always happy to have Tim back again. But anyway, Tim, how are you doing today, first of all, my friend?
I am doing well, and it's a rainy Saturday here in eastern Pennsylvania, and it's just a delight to be talking with you.
Well, look, great, man. Let me ask you, first of all, this abortion issue has just exploded. My thoughts are, I hate to put it in political terms, but to me, it almost gives in a perverse kind of a way, the abortion issue and the recent gun issue. And I, and folks, please don't think I'm being callous here, but we're having a discussion, a political discussion. I feel the same pain as everybody does for what occurred in Texas and in Buffalo. But I kind of think this is a wake-up call. All these issues are wake-up calls to the politics that we're going to have in November. Your thoughts on that?
Well, they are. And these are important issues. And, of course, Uvalde is critical. It's heartbreaking. I saw some additional stories this morning about some aspects of it that I wanted to share with my wife, but I wanted to tell her. I asked her, I said, it's bad. Do you want me to share this with you? And it's a heartbreaking story. But yet the follow-up to the story, we're all brokenhearted, but yet perhaps the insensitivity of many in order to perpetuate a political position is disturbing. And so while the discussion that we're having today, you know, I flippantly offer it as can progressives compromise on these issues? And as we go through the issues, certainly gun control or gun management can certainly be one of the issues, if you wish. You're the pilot of this plane, Egberto, so fly us where you wish.
Well, let's go ahead and tackle the abortion issue. I want to first tell you my thoughts on abortion, and I'd like to hear how it comes across to you, but or your thoughts per se. As it stands, I understand my own fallibility. I understand my own ignorance. I'll be honest, I don't know when life begins. I really don't. Whether an abortion is wrong or right, I don't know. The one thing that I do know is that I am a man. The other thing that I know is I don't see how I can have agency over somebody else's body. Now, when somebody else produces something, at that point, in my opinion, it is an independent being. But before that, I don't know. And in not knowing, I don't see how I can create laws. I don't see how I can tell a woman what to do. I'm interested to know if you fall in that domain or you think that, you know, you said you want to talk about compromise. Is there really compromise there or not?
It's the not knowing, Egberto, that really opens the door to this discussion and allows us to explore this. And maybe there is. I don't think anybody is pro-abortion. It's a nasty process. It's an unfortunate process. But we do have to be cognizant of being pro-choice or pro-rights. And certainly we need to live in that domain. But then, you know, I have this sympathy for the fetus at some point, you know, and you touched upon it by saying you don't know when life begins. Of course, we can take that all the way back. You know, we can say, well, it begins at conception, and many religious doctrines believe that. A recent Oklahoma candidate for governor, I believe, just said it begins before conception. One can imagine that. He says it's all part of God's plan. I know, you know.
How do you explain that, I wonder?
The Oklahoma candidate? He just says it's God's master plan. And then if he has a plan for life, and conception just perpetuates his plan for life. So be it, you know, the voters will decide. But at some point, you know, Mississippi, you know, we have a shock and outrage at their case going to the Supreme Court. But they said, let's ban abortion after 15 weeks. Now, neither you nor I know when life begins, but that's 4 months. You know, the child is starting to take shape. The woman has many, many signs of being pregnant at that. You know, it's not a mystery as it would be at 2 weeks. At some point, should it kick in that we really are creating a person, a marvelous process? And at some point, should we be acknowledging the beauty of this person and begin to protect it? Now, Colorado says you can get an abortion, I believe, almost up to term. And that is, again, if we think of the process, it's heartbreaking, you know? And so can we, as progressives, can we compromise? And we say, yeah, maybe at 15 weeks, pick the time, you know, conservatives and progressives, let's pick the time. But to assume some sort of responsibility in this decision-making process, as the man should too. I've heard it proposed that child support should begin at conception. Yeah, yeah, it should. And for prenatal care or whatever is going to happen, you know, it we're in this together. But this is one of those issues, you know, if we're well served by saying no abortion or pro-choice. As a corollary to that, Egberto, there was another Oklahoma that seems to be the nest of many traditional thoughts, I guess. But one female legislator said, if you want the rape and incest exemption, then you will have needed to report the police. And you think, well, you know, maybe there's a case there, you know. You know, if in fact, rather than just claim it to try and receive some sort of anti-abortion exemption. Very thought-provoking issues. And I'm wondering, can progressives compromise somewhere in there?
You know what is interesting? My feeling is, we have to compromise. Actually, I mean, I don't think it's whether we can or not. I think ultimately, to exist as a country, we have to compromise. But I tell you, believe it or not, for those people who really want control, I find that those who say abortion, irrespective, or rather, if those who think abortion is wrong, right? And they are not only saying that, but they're saying irrespective of whether it is rape or incest, et cetera, in a sort of perverse way, they're the most honest ones, right? Because they're saying that they believe that that which is within a woman's body is a life. And if that is a life and we have exceptions, the word would actually be, under these conditions, we are going to allow you to kill, if that is what you believe, right? And so I have a tendency to give the woman the right to do as she pleases, or else, again, if you have these exceptions, you're not really being honest with what you're calling a life. You're saying we offer to kill under these particular conditions, and it is a sort of fight that I have within my head, which in my case, it's like I would advise my daughter against an abortion. I would ask my daughter to be responsible. I would ask my daughter that if she's going to have a kid, to know that she has a family that will be there to back her no matter what. But I just feel that there's something about me imposing my family values onto somebody else.
And ultimately, it is your daughter's decision. But exactly. We would ask that her decision be made judiciously and as quickly as possible.
I would hate to think
it at the 8 months or something. And so really, at this point, Egberto, I would look forward to listener input on this. But at this point, I think everybody thinks abortion is bad. Most people think it's choice and she has that right. I'm wondering, can a time period be established in there? I hope so. This maybe to extend that olive branch discussion, maybe we can come up with something just.
I agree. Tim, that was a great piece on abortion. I'd love to hear what our audience have to say about that. Please put it in the chat. Let us see what your thoughts about what both Tim and I are talking about. Rick Scott's minimum tax. Rick Scott's minimum tax. I found that fascinating, especially coming from a Republican.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's proposing an increase in taxes on, I believe the number is like 50% of all Americans, and it was immediately shot down and everything. Anything from Rick Scott to be examined under a microscope, but the thought of everyone paying a little bit of tax, even if you make $5,000 a year and you pay $5, you know, it's not an abhorrent idea. And I know they're saying that it's regressive and will hurt poor people in some manners. If we tax poor people at 50%, yes, it will hurt, and it would not be fair and not just. But there's a symbolism here that may be valid. However, that validity depends on an examination of all the taxes, income taxes. You know, you can't have 5% at the bottom, and I think billionaires pay an effective rate of 3%. And as you know, Egberto, the lower income people pay a greater percentage of their income in taxes, overall taxes, than the wealthy do. So perhaps there should be some sort of wealth averaging in there. So maybe it would be to have lower income people pay 1%, make up a number. The percentages are not important, Egberto. It's the principle. But then does that, on average, across the United States, create an overall tax burden on poor people, make up a number again, 20%. Okay, then perhaps we should have a corresponding overall tax burden for the wealthy of 20%. Play with the numbers however you wish. But Rick Scott's minimum tax, while causing shock and awe amongst many people, especially progressives, there's a principle there. that perhaps would be valid. And I would love to hear your thought on that.
Let me put it this way. The reason why, for me, Rick Scott tax is obscene, right, is what it doesn't take into account is the reason why people don't pay income taxes, right? And that reason is that they make so little. I rather look at it from the perspective that everybody is paying taxes right now. If you go and buy gas, there are sales taxes, there are federal gas taxes, there are all these other taxes that they're paying. My problem is, it's interesting, right? Because why do we pay taxes on a percentage of our income as opposed to something else? And that's above my pay grade. I don't posit that I know all these answers, because I don't. But here's my thing. For those people who study percentages, et cetera, right? What happens is, if you're a billionaire, and even if you're paying the same percentage as that poor person, or even a larger percentage, the mere fact that you're a billionaire and this person is way down here means that there is never a time that the tax system can be used to correct what I call the aberration of capitalism, which is, it is biased towards those who have capital. And as such, those without capital, or those with a small amount of capital in their lifetime, could never really attain, unless invited, that level. So I think they make a straw person out of those people who just don't make enough to pay taxes, as opposed to look at the other structural problems we have in our economic system. So that is my concern with it. It's almost like the wrong argument or the wrong discussion, if you will.
Yeah, I agree in a sense. The accumulation of wealth is horrific. If a person making $10,000 a year and they're taxed at 5%, they're paying $500, and they have $9,500 that accumulates conceivably. But the billionaire who pays 5% pays $50 million and has $950 million accumulating. You know, and so it boggles the mind. So income, let alone whether capital or labor, they should be valued the same. But income tax, a woefully inadequate measure of economic justice. There needs to be a wealth tax involved. In the Federalist Papers, they acknowledge that we need to have an inheritance tax, lest we create a royal class that we hand down wealth within the family, and that wealth accumulates. And so, of course, everything needs to be placed on the table. Tax system right now is a tremendous injustice in America. There's an alternative. Used to be an alternative minimum tax for the wealthy, and I think that has been put by the wayside. But maybe we bring that back. Judiciously, I think it might be okay for even the poorest person to pay a token amount. You know, everybody pays in, but I understand that the purpose of I understand the purpose of this and what makes a person poor, minimum wage, whatever it is. It is complicated. And we could probably, Egberto, have 10 discussions on that aspect of it. But everybody paying at least a little bit, that causes pause to reflect. And I'm not appalled by it. But there's a lot of caveats on that.
I feel exactly what you're saying, and I know you're not appalled by it, because there's this thing within all of us that say, let every single person have some skin in the game. I think is one of the words that you were probably looking for earlier on. Have skin in the game, have skin in paid income tax. The thing about it, though, for me is it's not skin in the tax game, but it is skin in the totality of the economy. And that is why I actually believe, and we are not talking about this particular subject, but I think it's sort of germane to what to the tax situation, and that is why I believe in things like redistribution or things like the give backs that we have right now in the child tax credit and these other options. The reason why is that we are all of us that are working. Anybody that's successfully working in this economy, they're making America better. If you're a McDonald's employee, a place where you make so little money that many times you are on welfare, meaning you and I support somebody who cannot make it at McDonald's, even though they're putting in an 8-hour work week. And I don't know about you, but I love McDonald's, you know. And
Egberto, I may offer Walmart as an example. Because of the urban renewal credits,
yes.
And because of the low pay they offer people, and their people are on welfare and subsidized incomes and so forth, they are really one of the biggest tax grifters in the United States. So McDonald's, let's get it where it really hits, and that's Walmart.
Exactly. Whoops, perfect. That's a perfect example, actually. And so what I'm saying is, I think Rick Scott brought the argument, let everybody have skin in the game, is what Rick Scott is saying. And that has a good feeling of responsibility, right? But I think what everybody has skin in the game in is that they work. They work productively in society. And for me, it's sort of like if you work productively in society, you should have the right to live at least a minimal life, which many people don't right now. And as such, I think our tax system should be used to sort of ensuring that. The economic system can be as draconian as it is, but that our tax system be used to move monies around to ensure that everybody has a good standard of living. That's my thoughts.
Well, Egberto, in all honesty, if I were to design a tax, I would probably start with the premise that the first $80,000 of income is tax-free based on our rights to pursue life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Here you go. You could compromise there.
Then we start kicking in some high percentages.
Right.
I don't think that has much of a chance, but that honestly, that is where I would start and go from there.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good start. I mean, the idea being that, a lot of people, we've gotten a lot of people trying to talk. I tell you what, and then we can go to the next subject, Tim. What I don't understand with the super, super wealthy, right? Is what is it, or what do they really want with that, all the money that they've attained? And by the way, I don't think anybody has attained their wealth solely from their work. Let me give an example. You are somebody that I have a whole lot of respect for. You formed your company, you go out there with your guys and you get things done, and you're actually a part of you're what's called an active investor in your own company. However, most of the wealthy, they're not active investors in what's been accomplished. They have capital and they can go ahead and say, I want to do X, Y, and Z. And the others are peons. I have a term for it. I don't know if you're going to like it. I call it antiseptic slavery because, again, they just sit back there and everybody does work. And when they say, my money is working for me, what they really mean is somebody else is making money and they are taking a piece of it. Unlike, again, all of us are guilty to some extent when we collect interest or a little bit of stock appreciation, but those guys do it to the max. Now, I want a system where we don't stifle innovation. In other words, I don't think, Tim, for the work that you do, I don't think there's anything right now that is stifling your ability to do what you're doing. But I think under the current system, right, it is not you who benefit, your status quo, but they're those guys who are out there, the ones that are complaining the most, that I just call the cancer to our society.
Well, I'll close this so we can go on to another topic, but I once interviewed a professor Fitz, I believe, from Washington University in St. Louis, a psychologist who examined this. But making money it is not that different from a drug addiction. You always want the bigger hit.
I agree with that.
And it's an illness that's all consuming that destroys many perspectives except.
Oops, I guess our fix didn't necessarily work because you kind of faded out again, but there was enough said there that we got through just fine. But next subject is the filibuster. And let me go ahead and say, because by the way, folks, these list of topics came directly from Brother Tim here, because, when we talk, we always like to discuss things within our body politics. And I said, hey, please, let's have those topics from you, Tim, because it's been a long time since we've had this type of discussion. Filibuster. I think the filibuster is the most undemocratic thing, especially in a time where we have the internet that everybody can know everything on a dime. I think it is being used where less than 40% of the population can control the entire discourse, can control the entirety of what we accomplish in this country. And I think it has to be, I think it needs to go altogether. I would be surprised to hear what your thoughts are.
I don't want to sound like Alito, talking about original intent or anything like that, but I do want to take a moment and take a look at the intent. First of all, let me say I agree with you. As it occurs right now, it's horribly abused, it's politicized, and it's awful, undemocratic, unfair. It's wrong in every sense of the word at this point. If we take a look at the intent, we've always worked with majority rule, minority rights. A respect. And I lost your voice. I hope you have mine.
Tim, I think, you just mentioned a very important concept that very few people understand. The rights as being preventing the tyranny of the majority. Why don't you explain that a little bit before you get into that discourse?
Well, what it is if everything was straight majority rule, it can be ruled by hysteria. We can be ruled by group polarization. We can be ruled by confirmational biases, where people all of a sudden rush into this and no one gets the opportunity to say, time out. Let's think about this a minute. Voice be heard. We could steamroll legislation without consideration for the minority. And that is kind of what the filibuster is there for. Its intent was to buy time to rally the people to see if we could effectively change the discourse and the votes. And so, but right now, just about any senator, and truthfully, it's mostly Mitch McConnell, would just say, no, I don't even want to vote on it. And there's no discussion about why he doesn't want to vote on it, which is horribly unjust. But maybe we should have an old-time filibuster. Mr. Smith goes to Washington to a degree, okay, where we say, you've got 96 hours, and you got to be on the floor, and you got to present in this 96 hours children's books, go 96 hours and try and rally your base. Use the social media. Use whatever you want to try and get your 40%, 51%. After that, we're going to take a vote. I think while we need to have majority rule, I think we need to use the filibuster as a timeout, just to say, before we rush into this vote, people need to hear this. And I think that that would be an effective and fair use of the filibuster rather than just say, let's ban it.
The thing about it, though, then in that regards, right, and I think this is why a lot of these politicians don't see it that way, is that they use the filibuster to permanently ban something. And what that does is it means that you truly have minority rule. Now, I think it's important for most Americans to understand, because a lot don't really know that, that the filibuster is not a constitutional construct. Mm-hmm. The filibuster is just a set of rules they decided to create in the Senate. And the other thing that I want to mention is that the difference between comparing, let's say, the rights that we have, the Bill of Rights, which ensures that, you know, no matter who you are, whatever you are, the majority cannot take away the freedom of press. The majority cannot take away your citizenship. The majority cannot. I mean, these are rights, things that, irrespective of what the majority wants, applies to you, an inalienable right. The filibuster is a bit different, right? In that it is, and I like what you said, it is supposed to give you a time out just to let you rethink things. But if the things that you have to rethink isn't something that's an inalienable right, I think the vote must go on. Because again, if it's, I think it should go on.
It must. It must. Because, you know, the filibuster not only is unconstitutional, it's undemocratic. You know, it violates every principle that we have as a final determinant of legislation. However,
right.
It is a timeout of law. People need to know.
I lost your entire phrase. You went silent.
Okay. I'm just saying it's just something that we need to have as a timeout. You know, it's a wise thing to have for 96 hours, 4 days. So it can get out there, hit the media, hit the social media, and then yes. Let people talk to their legislator. And take over the airwaves. It's not that bad, but as a legislative determinant, who we vote on and what don't we, it's bad.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're pretty much in agreement there. I think we hope the guys listen to us. Next subject, though. And I don't know how we're going to hit this one here, but student forgiveness, tuition forgiveness. I'm going to tell you, when I went to college, I came here, I had to pay a whole lot of money for college, more so than the Americans, because at the time that I got here, I was a foreign student. Eventually I got a residency, and which allowed me to get in-state tuition, which was a lot better, but still I had to take out some student loans while I was going to college. And I paid my student loans off completely on my own. But I tell you what, when I watched my daughter, who has much bigger bills than I had, even when adjusted for inflation, what I see is a system that constantly asks the students to pay more. Now, before I come back, I want to say that I think that students are actually a sort of subsidy for, if you're not going to work for yourself, like let's say you and me, we work for ourselves. But if you're going to work for a corporation, I actually think that that college is a subsidy to corporations, because what we have is somebody gets an education and goes to work prepared. That corporation supposedly doesn't have to spend all their money preparing that person. Now, that said, Tim, interestingly, what it means then is that we have been cutting corporations' responsibility towards taxes that really helps build colleges, universities, and tuition, I think is a problem. And I think by now we need to have some sort of a reset. Tuition forgiveness, it's above my pay grade to understand how it should be done. I leave that up to you.
Well, let's talk about a couple of things. First of all, the value of a college education. And Egberto, I'd be curious to know if you share my belief on this. I believe I got my associate's at community college. I got a bachelor's at a state university, and I got my master's at a private school. Okay. I believe I learned more in community college than I did going for my master's. You know, I learned to call BS. I learned about social issues. It broadened and opened my mind tremendously. The rest of it was just majors and details, you know, college majors. And
I am sorry, Tim. You said the rest of it was what again?
The rest of it was just details.
Right.
In the sense of whatever the major was that I was going to go. But the first 2 years are expansive and they're valuable. And truthfully, I believe community colleges should be free. And I would not give loan forgiveness on the first 2 years of college.
Let me first say I agree with you that I mean, a lot of college is detail. Unfortunately, it's what a lot of corporations want to see. Now, let me just give a perfect example. My degree, mechanical engineering, my original job that made me most of my money, programming computers. Where did I learn to program computers? On my own. And I say, in other words, all the college that I've gotten, I can tell you that I could have learned everything there was about computer programming and had all the jobs that I had for corporations. Now, college, was the college a waste of time? Absolutely not. I think I learned a whole lot of techniques and so forth that college was good for. But I think it proves your point that it's a lot more complex as far as what's really beneficial to you to be a successful human being in whatever profession you choose. So I'm with you there.
Yeah. And should we give 10,000 forgiveness to the person who goes to Yale, a private school or something? Probably not. I should not have had, I mean, I paid my own way, but you know, I would never ask for loan forgiveness when I went to a private school. It just shouldn't be that way. However, there's a couple things that factor into this. This country has a doctor shortage. We do not have an increased number of doctors, despite our population increasing 30% over the last 40 years. And maybe we should give loan forgiveness for anybody going to become a doctor. We have to face the fact we have a $2 or $3 trillion infrastructure requirement coming up. And maybe we should be offering bigger discounts for people going into engineers. Maybe there needs to be a value to certain tuitions, which also I might offer. And I'm kind of wandering here a little bit, Eduardo, and I apologize for that. But should we be offering loan forgiveness for Greek archaeology to the same degree as we do for a family practitioner, for which we are in a dire shortage? In fact, we're short on family practitioners because it doesn't pay as well as the specialists, and then the specialists can afford to pay their tuition quicker. So they choose doctoral graduates pick specialties. Should colleges then, we put take the burden back to them, should they be charging the same for freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, or should they be saying our Greek archaeology? And I value Greek archaeology, believe it or not. There's a lot we need to learn, a lot of things we don't know. But should we value that? Should the tuition for Greek archaeology be the same as a pre-med? Probably not. But yet colleges need to forward on this too.
I have actually changed my mind on this. In my very leftist way of being and wanting to give people as much, given that society is so unfair and for those who, for the very small amount of wealth that's really made it, a lot of times I want to say, yes, sack it to them, take that and pay off all tuitions. And even though I paid my own, I don't really mind that. But I think listening to folks like yourself and others, I think it has to be more, it is best if done in more of a measured way. So in that regards, I have actually tempered my beliefs on whether to just go ahead and wholeheartedly, you know, pay everything, or try to be a bit more selective, maybe a baseline with some selectivity in how we do it. So, yeah, I think enough folks have spoken to me, both online and off channel to tell me maybe I need to modify how I believe in tuition forgiveness. And by the way, you're one of them too.
Well, thank you. But definitely community college, you know, you get the same, I believe you would get the same education at the first 2 years of community college, by and large, as you would at the first 2 years of an Ivy League school. You know, it's the same type of courses. And incidentally, I should mention to you for just a little anecdote, sort of related, kind of not related. I was once on a project and I was talking to a billionaire. And, you know, he was surprised. I had my master's degree. Out. I'm sorry, the sound? I cannot hear you, Egberto.
I was talking to a billionaire, so, and then I missed out.
I was talking to a billionaire on one of my projects, a guy who makes a lot of his money from solar windmills or windmills out in the ocean. And, you know, I said, I have my MBA from University of Denver, and I'm very proud of it because my understanding is the University of Denver is ranked second in the world for teaching business ethics. And I said, it's marvelous. And he goes, well, he got his MBA from Yale. And I told him, oh, I'm sorry. and he laughed, too.
Wait, you told a guy you're sorry he came from Yale.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the school of Jared Kushner. I believe Mark Zuckerberg, you know, George W. Bush, you know, and the list, you know, and you're just thinking, I believe Paul Manafort. I mean, we could put together a hall of shame for many of the Yale graduates. So anyway, it was a little bit of a joke on this thing, and I don't mean to distract, but the billionaire took it in stride, and he understood. And you want to know something? The way he looked at me made me think, you know, he was very magnanimous and contributed a lot of money to many things. The way he looked at me, he says, like, should they be teaching business ethics at Yale? Who knows? Maybe someday he'll do something. But nonetheless, community college for everybody is good. Writing off the student loans for someone who goes to Yale, I'm not as excited.
I am with you there, man. Okay, let's go ahead. This is an interesting subject to talk about, and that is homelessness, right? I tell you something. I'm going to tie homelessness, which you want to talk about, with another subject at hand. I'm going to tie it into gentrification, and I'm going to also tie it into corporations that are going around the country buying up stressed properties, and in the process of buying up stressed properties, not reselling them into the market, but renting them as a new form of capital appreciation, and not capital appreciation, but bringing in income on, you know, capital that was attained on the cheap. I think homelessness is something we all agree that it's bad, but I also think that there are some defects within our economic system that allows that to flourish. We can look at Atlanta, we can look at New York, we can look at San Francisco, we can look at all these other places where we have allowed these corporations to do certain things within the markets that give a false appreciation, which then leads to homelessness. And I'll be curious to see your thoughts on homelessness in general and how gentrification and these other issues have actually mitigated it.
Well, it's kind of interesting how the conversation appears to wander, but it doesn't. You know, we talk about Jared Kushner and Yale, and sure enough, he's one of the ones that buy up a lot of low-income properties. I believe Baltimore is one of his current hotspots, and then he raises the rents and have the income and evicts people and so forth. So who'd ever think that there would be a segue for this? But I am frighteningly draconian about homelessness. Tennessee just passed a law that you're not allowed to camp on public property. And I get it. I do. I get it. And I just think bless your heart, Egberto, you got to let me take this one to the end of the paragraph. And I lost your volume there.
But go for it.
yeah, to the end of the paragraph. But I think people that are camping on public property need to be taken to facilities. They need to be given housing, temporary housing, where they can do an evaluation. Is this a mental health issue? Many of them are. And I would like to offer mental health counseling. Is it a trade and unemployment issue? If it is, I would like to offer them training, assistance seeking jobs. You know, is it a coming out of prison thing? I've talked with people that have come out of prison and they get $20 and they're dropped off at the bus station. If that's what it is, I want to offer assistance. Is it a drug issue? If it is, I would like to take them to that temporary housing and offer them drug rehabilitation. There are more. There are four right there. There are more. But I don't think they have the right to be on the street. Downtown Denver now, for all the glamour and glitz, is uninhabitable due to syringes, homelessness, feces on the street. I suppose that it's similar in other major cities. This cannot occur, but we need to take the homeless people off the streets and we need to help them. And that's kind of where I'm at.
Well, I mean, you are where everybody needs to be. You are not asking, you are not saying, I want you off the streets, but I don't care what happens to you. You are saying, let's make the streets pleasurable for everybody. And those people who need help, let's give them help. That is a lot more humane, or that is the humane solution, as opposed to what you see in a lot of these cities where they just throw these guys out and move, you know, try to get them or hose them away or, you know, I mean, so I think what you're saying is exactly what the kind of things that we should do. But let me tell you, Brother Danahy, we are pretty much out of time. So what I want to ask you is this. There are three more subjects that we want to talk about, and that is English as an official language, election reform, and electoral college. So here's what I'm going to ask you, because we only have about 3 minutes or so left. I'd love for you to tell me your thoughts on English as an official language in a few sentences.
I think it should be. Okay. And I know that we try to be polyglot as a nation, but I think we should. And I once told you that, and I think you reacted with some surprise, but there's 200 languages and I cannot learn them all, but I want to learn what the thoughts are of 200 different sets of people. I want to hear their thoughts. We need to have a universal language, and English, I believe, would be the most proper. And I think we need to offer English education for anyone requesting it. I believe it's essential. And then we can begin the understanding the Hmong from Laos or Farsi, so we can understand the Persian expatriates or whatever. But we need everyone to speak English so we can share our thoughts.
You know, I've been going back and forth with that one, and I think I'm coming around that we should all in this country have two languages, English as a common language and some other language. I am a bilingual person. I speak English and Spanish. Understand a little bit of Portuguese. But the thing about it is, I think it is so important that, yes, now I'm seeing that not knowing English can actually be, can deprive others, you know, deprive folks of success within the country itself. So I am coming around to saying not just English as an official language, but English, but our curriculum must include another language as well.
Yeah, pick a language. I agree. I had to take Spanish in school. My son had to take French, whatever. Yeah,
so there you go. I appreciate it. Next subject, election reform. Thoughts?
I don't really have a problem with voter ID. But once again, I think we need to encourage people to get either a driver's license or a state ID. And if we could negotiate on that and say, okay, conservatives, we'll do voter ID. But you need to improve access to voting. You know, I think we could find a common ground there. And I think voter ID would be something that progressives could use as a chip for other issues involved with access to votes?
I think everybody needs to be identified. So I don't really have a problem with voter ID. I think a lot of problems with people like myself who have issues with when we talk about voter ID is that in Texas, you can't use a state-issued university card as a voter ID, but you can use a rifle, you can use a gun permit. Yeah. That is where the differences are, I think. Now, on Electoral College is in last subject. I completely want the Electoral College gone. I think it's one of the most undemocratic things that we have right now. California gets two senators, which is meaning two votes in the Electoral College based on the Senate portion, while North Dakota gets two as well. Their populations are I think it's one of these states. California is 40 times the population, and they have the same weighted amount based on the Senate. I think that is undemocratic, and I don't think we can preach democracy around the world as long as that stands. Your thoughts?
I understand. The Electoral College was kind of a constitutional compromise. And it was introduced because less populous states wanted to be heard. And it becomes kind of a minority issue again. But yet it has gone to the extreme where do you want New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago deciding the elections of the country? Or do we want to make sure that places like Wyoming has a voice? Perhaps I get the majority rule and absolute democratization of electing a national official, a president. But I understand the need for Wyoming to have a small voice in all of this. I just want to say I can argue this both ways. I do understand. But once again, I think we need to see if this is a point of discussion or compromise. I don't think this is an absolute issue.
Tom, or Tim Danahy, my brother, we can have conversations for hours as we've had before. I mean, we've stayed in Colorado before and sat down with a cup of coffee and spoke hour after hour after hour at our meetings. Look, we're gonna do this again. And hopefully we'll do it pretty soon as a new program. I can't wait for us to get that done because I tell you, there are a myriad of subjects that I think we can discuss this way. As most of the people can see right now, you and I don't see eye to eye on everything. I mean, both of us are what I consider just people, but, you know, I think if people see people able to disagree in an agreeable manner and also open themselves up for a change of opinion, I think it's a good beginning for the country. So I can't wait for us to get our program together when your schedule gets a little bit better than it is right now. So thank you so kind. Oh, well, I forgot. I always ask the last question. Please give me a closer. Give me something that you wish I'd asked you that I didn't.
I can't think of anything. You're always very thorough in your conversations, and I'm very appreciative for that. I suppose one thing you could ask is, when can we do this again? And as soon as possible.
Well, look, thank you very much, Tim. It's been my pleasure to have you on Politics Done Right. Until we meet again, my brother.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead. Number one, subscribe to our channel. And number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.